Wright. I'm a senior producer in the development bit of BBC I, which is what interactive TV and new TV technologies of the future is called this month. Some of you might remember that last year's NotCon spoke a little bit about why interactive TV was the web, why that was a good thing. This year I'm pleased to say that we've got a couple of examples of stuff that you can do with TV streams that are available over air now. In some cases not needing a net connection, just needing one or two busy parts. I'm joined here by Dominic Luggan, the Luggan family, who are going to be showing us Pandora's Box, and Stephen Jolly of Kings of Warren Research and Development Part of the BBC, who's going to be showing us various bits and bobs with what happens when you poke around the rocket stream. The stuff we do in interactive TV at the moment is divided up into two areas, I suppose. One is the consumer-facing stuff, pressing red on Sky, on Preview, or in some cases on cable. Gives you information, multi-stream, you're probably aware of some of that sort of games. The second thing that we're looking at is kind of what happens next after that. There's a lot of talk in the BBC and outside about ways that new tech can change viewing habits, ways it's going to, you know, destroy the schedule, yada yada yada. Lots of areas thinking about that and make how we can tell about that. What we've started doing about the last 6 to 12 months is actually try and make this for real. One of the things that we were quite pleased and surprised was how relatively easy it is to do just by going to MacBooks. 44 quid, BT2 PCI card, Linux box, various distros, lights around, fairly good support for all of the standard BT2 cards, and you can start to play. Backstage, the internet version has been going for a wee while now. We are currently looking at how we can get involved. Get people like yourselves in bedrooms or in small companies or large web shops or indeed in interactive TV development shops involved. There's a large amount of work that's going on for interactive TV on Sky and on cable. There's very little that we see for stuff on DTT. DTT excites us a lot because it's the way that people are going to get TV in this country, predominantly free to air, once we get switch off. It's fun because there's various tools available. What does that mean? It's still relatively theoretical, but when it comes to practical is when you have a box on your desk or in your lounge at home, which can record a hell of a lot of television, way more than a PDR like Sky Pass or a PDR like TiVo. Way more. That really starts to change how TV works, what it is, what happens if you miss something. So I kind of look at that now to demonstrate some of this in action.
Can you flip the source of that? Oh,
this is all about digital TV, which has been a sort of fairly recent thing to come to the UK. What happens when that meets all ordinary, everyday quality Linux computing, standard desktop PC parts? So, television's been around for a very long time. It's a very large part of our lives. It's been around as long as the jet engine, which is a sort of pop fact, but it arguably has much more impact on our lives. It's integrated into our very fabric of society. And just give a very brief history. You had black and white back in the 40s, and then you had an event that was a catalyst for a lot of people to uptake ITVs for the very first time. You then had ITV, which was the first time you had a competition in channels, and people had choice about what they wanted to watch, and scheduling came into effect, that the idea that you could compete with someone else at a particular time to grab people's attention. Then the 65 lines, which was the precursor to colour, and was the first major upgrade part. Mm-hmm. Then colour happened, and then everyone got on board after that. And more latterly, you had videos in the 80s, and interestingly with that VHS, the format that won out, was pushed as more of a time-shifting, the Philips at the time and Betamax were more pushing for a time shift kind of aspect to what videos would do for the home than VHS, and VHS went down the route of having getting movies on VHS that can go to the video shop and rent. And that was a big win, that really didn't, no one, far more people used it as a vehicle for watching movies in the evening than did want to record things. It was very hard to record, legendary, very hard to record.
What do you call?
Yes, that's true. Video Plus came along as an effort to try and sort of help people work out what the hell to do with their video recorders, and it was reasonably successful. And then latterly, the important things are that TiVo and WPTV came along where they had relatively small hard drives, and for the first time you could time shift programs and record things direct to disk rather than to a tape. And so where are we now? We are, Freeview is very widespread in the UK, it's got a lot of coverage. We have Linux drivers for all of the major DVD cards you can get. And a single hard drive, well, that size, is 400 gigabytes in size. That's quite crucial, because a lot of this hinged upon that drive being released, that density being achieved. But throughout all of this, what has not happened? What has not changed about TV? Well, it's the scheduling. It's the idea that it's a stream that you use, you dip into, and you can come out of. You may be able to record the old program here or there, but you have to deliberately set up a TiVo or whatever box you want to go up and record it. You may record it regularly, but you have to tell it to do it. It's something that you it doesn't guess for you, or it can, but it's that's not there. It's not as wide as it can be. So you can now shift the entire stream. That the idea is that you actually don't care about recording individual programs. You record it all. You record the entire thing, the transport stream, as it comes down, and then put it on the disk, and then keep it around, and for as much storage as you've got, you then get rid of it. And that really is a radical change in terms of how you interact with your TV, that it's much more of a change than disc recording of a particular program to disc that you know is going to be there. This will have things that you don't know there. This really does say, take the entire concept of Tuesday's work output and keep it on disc, and you can go visit it whenever you want. So I think we should do a little bit of a demo now. Right, should we flip the
Can you switch it back to Dr. Who?
Do you want to do this, Tom?
Sure.
Here it is, still watching Dr. Who. I can switch back to.
But there we have the system. Here it is in the live demo. This is and is recording everything. It has on it. For the past 7 days, it has 5 channels. Throughout which you can go back any time, you can sit down and choose any time in that past time, pick a program and watch it. Here they are. This is last Friday, Dr. Who have been watching, so already you've been watching a program that was broadcast last Friday. You can go back and go back. Any time, all the way back to last Saturday. All these programs you have available to us. That's BBC 3, BBC 2, BBC 1, BBC News 24, CBBC, BBC, and BBC 4. Any programme in the past 7 days, you can pick. So let's say you used to sit down to watch the 10 o'clock news on BBC 1. Well, it used to be a pattern. You have to make sure you get home, sit down in front of the TV. Oh, that's 10 o'clock in the morning. Now you don't. You sit down when you've got a free moment, you can go through, flick through the programmes, and watch BBC News at 10 o'clock. There it is. From here, it's actually shifting the entire multiplex. It's just shifting the entire channel. So from here, we can switch to BBC 2. And we're still Thursday, 10 o'clock. If you missed a bit, if you chop the beginning of the program off, it doesn't matter. You can wind it back before you start recording. And if you keep going back 5 seconds until you got to last week. So here is the ultimate in time shifting. Don't have to set everything up. You don't have to go down the pub and have someone say, oh, no, are you going to watch something or other tonight? Well, it doesn't matter. You can watch it when you get back home. And this actually changes the way you might want to watch programmes in the future as well. So now you've got a free moment, you sit down in front of your TV and you say, what's available? So now you've got a collection of 1,500 programmes that you can sort of choose from for a broadcast over the past week. And you want to find something that's perhaps, instead of looking for a particular time and saying, what would broadcast here on this channel and on this time, I want to watch a movie. So we can search these programmes through categories as well. So if I want to watch an entertainment program, we can go back and say, ah, Titanic, I don't know when it's broadcast, but I want to watch it. Here it is. So it's basically a revolution in TV. You no longer have to sit down and care what time it is. You sit down and you choose serve me some interesting content.
There's a little bit I want to chat about the kind of areas that this then touches on. What does this mean? It has implications for how, as Dominic said, how you sift through all this stuff. 1,500 programs is a lot to press the right button and scroll through your XY grid. And really, you maybe are only interested in the prime time doing, sort of 6 till 10, or whatever it is. It also changes the fact that TV is this sort of subconscious clock that you have running in your house that really you time events by it, and slowly but surely that's being eroded by TiVo and the concept that particular programs that you want to watch that you set up are there at your disposal. But this totally removes the notion about time for a stream, and then it then subsequently has an effect on. When, what programs broadcast, when, and who even who broadcast. So yeah, as I said, interestingly, the genre stuff is already seen with podcasting, that you browse by tags, and you look at the description and the program name, but really it's all about this sort of collection of keywords that are assigned to programs. And although this exists in TV, there's currently a project underway called TV Anytime at the moment, which is to elaborate on the metadata that is broadcast with the stream. And so, yeah, so a couple of the scenarios that you can now have with this is that. So it's recorded it anyway. Whether or not you wanted it or not, or you didn't know about it until now, it's there anyway. Really, it's that you never ever have to program this thing to record anything you want at all. It just does it. For as much hard drive space as you've got n weeks of working TV across however many channels you want. And then the other scenario is. What if you come across a program but part one's already been broadcast? Well, you can shift back a week and watch that program now, and then watch the second part that's broadcast as you're watching the first one. It's really that you've got a gigantic buffer there in which to do your programs. And then another interesting one is that you start not to care about certain things. when it was on. So what is daytime TV? If you've got the ability to shift it all, it doesn't matter actually when it arrives in your box, as long as it's there, it's a feed. It drips programs into this pot. You then don't care whether it's BBC One or Two. It doesn't matter. It may be repeated. It really is not important to you how it got there. And then the logical sort of extrapolation of that is that you actually don't care who broadcasts it, be it ITV or BBC or Channel 4. It doesn't matter. It's actually the content that you're interested in, not the manner in which it got there, not the whether it's got adverts or whatever. You know, but it arrives in your box and you watch it, and then it gets deleted and you move on to the next episode. So it really has a very far-reaching ramification about the nature of the TV stream that we have and scheduling. And this is part of what George was talking about earlier. So we put up a little bit of a website about this box, and it's at that URL, punch.tv, if you want to have a quick look. It's just a placeholder right now, but we should be putting up some information about what this box represents shortly.
Thanks for that. So if we can move on to Stephen, and at the end, if we can come back, I'm sure you've got lots of questions. Questions about the box, questions about what the BBC is doing with it, etc.
Hello, I'm Steve Joy. I work at BBC R&D, and I'm going to talk to you first about some of the early technologies that have been developing at R&D, many of which you may have seen on that demo stand upstairs, which will also be mounted a bit after this talk, so you can have a look there if you haven't already seen them. And then I'm going to be trying to persuade you to do backstage.bbc-style stuff with the content that we broadcast, rather than just the stuff which we distribute via the internet. So, I'm going to start with talking about Dirac, which is the thing you're most likely to have heard of, to be honest. It's a new video codec, which we're developing at BBC R&D in collaboration with people from the open source community. It's free. You can download it from source forward under your choice of user-friendly license. It's patents and royalty-free, and the asterisk next to the word patent there means that, yes, there are some aspects of it that we at the BBC have patented, but they've been licensed to anyone who wants to use them on a royalty-free rate basis. And it's comparable in quality to the best of its competitors, so Microsoft's Windows Media Line, for example, or DMA for ABC codec. And it is, as I mentioned, free. So why on earth would the BBC want to develop an open source video codec? And the first and foremost reason is that we ought to spend our money on programs, not on encoding videos to send to people. And pretty much all the existing codecs require royalties. We want to distribute our programs as efficiently as possible, which means we want to use the best coding technology available. So we want to best develop that codec ourselves on our own terms, but obtaining help from other interested parties. And finally, we want it to be open source because we want the license payer, who often is funding all this work, to be able to use the software that they pay for. Here are some potential uses for Dirac. Within the BBC, we would like the Creative Archive, which you probably heard of, to be based around Dirac. Creative Archive is the idea that a lot of the BBC's older content, especially factual stuff, will be available for anyone in the UK to reuse and repurpose and make it to their programs, etc. Obviously, for news, for distributing video from news gathering to back to the studio, Dirac would be an attractive royalty-free option. And also, if you want live distribution of video, I'm sure everyone here is sort of having had to download real to watch music clips on the BBC website. It would be fantastic if we could do that in a slightly less real fair oriented fashion. And also for signing for deaf people on television. If you've watched News24 recently, you'll notice that for about an hour every afternoon, all of a sudden the picture shrinks to 2/3 of its size, and a strange man appears waving his arms around. Now, we have a commitment within the BBC to provide signing for our deaf viewers. But at the same time, we don't want to annoy non-deaf people by forcing them to put up with signing. So we would like to use what's called closed signing, where you can turn on or off the little man as you wish. But broadcasting pictures will then require bandwidth. So we'd like to use Direct for that and broadcast closed side either within the broadcast stream or the internet in a bandwidth efficient manner. And that is currently an ongoing project that I need to see whether we can do that. So there has been interest in Direct from industry. I can't mention specific names, but a number of very large technology and broadcast companies have expressed an interest in incorporating Direct into some of their products. And at home, it's possible that Direct will appear in your set-top boxes at some point. It's possible that the screensaver on my laptop will come on. And obviously, in your home DVRs, you may wish to use Direct to a decent amount of space at the program to record take up. And obviously, Direct is open source, you can use it as a video game, any software you care to write. So, I'm not going to say very much about the technology. That's because it's very complicated and I don't actually understand it for myself. The key difference between Direct and existing Direct is that it uses wavelets. Now, I'm not going to say anything about how wavelets work, I'm going to say they make pictures look like that. So rather than blocky pictures, which you get when if you switch on your preview box and go out to your TV and stare really closely, you can see that the picture shows lots of blocky and MPEG artifacts. Direct doesn't give you blocks, it gives you kind of blurred, smooth bits instead, which for moving pictures look a lot nicer. Motion compensation, that's a technique where the codec looks at the difference between two frames and tries to work out whether bits of the picture have moved or not, and then takes that into account to reduce the actual amount of information that needs to be transmitted. And then arithmetic coding is a packing method which takes the encoded stream and packs it as efficiently as possible, minimizing redundancy. And those three tools, tools is the technical name for those things, they are. Those three tools are basically the sum of Dirac, and its simplicity is one of the things which makes it so attractive. So some of the software which already supports Dirac, VLC, mPlayer, with a patch which we can download for the website, Windows Media Player, if you download Dirac Direct Show Filter, FFmpeg and Transcode, both with patches. And we've done the best we can to make adding support to other players as simple as possible. There's a simple C-based API and there's copious documentation available on the website. So if your favorite media player is not yet supported, then please feel free to consider implementing support for it. The future for Dirac. By September, we will hope to have real-time playback and TV quality video on PC. By the end of 2005, Dirac will be a beta. And what that means is the bitstream format will be fixed. So if you encode Dirac with one version of the codec, then you'll be able to decode it with any future version. And then in 2006, we hope to have a release quality version, which it's hard to define when the product hits 1.0, because of course the development will probably continue. But that's a point where we're saying, yes, this is now perfectly usable in any product that you think of. And we will probably standardize Dirac through W3C, so there will be an open, publicly available free standard for Dirac and how that works. And yes, we do want help. We've had a fantastic response from people wanting to contribute to the project up from outside the BBC already. But if you can run software, documentation, or generally be incredibly enthusiastic, then we'd love to have you help us. And if you're worried about it, then that's the Dirac campaign page there. You can find out more than you wanted to know. So I'm going to talk very briefly about Camellia. Michael Sparks, who's sitting in the audience, gave a lightning talk about it in one of the early sessions today. Camellia is a Python-based framework for creating highly modular concurrent applications. So think about Unix pipes and piping together from another Unix shell, but in a much more flexible fashion. It was designed as a testbed for large-scale media delivery protocols, but it's generally useful in the sense that you can use it for pretty much any application you care to think of. Again, it's an open source piece of software, and again, it's available on source code. And again, there's a growing community of people who are interested in the project, and we would love to you to be involved with that if you feel so inclined. Now, the open technologies we develop in the BBC are not limited to stuff which will be of interest to consumers. The chances are that unless you work in the broadcast industry, the media dispatch protocol will never be installed on your computer. But this is a protocol which we're developing within the broadcast industry to get around the problem of having to send large video files between broadcasters using motorbikes. We feel that networks will be a more efficient technology. So again, this is an open protocol being developed collaboratively. For what it's worth, it's using a XML manifest to describe the transfer requirements, giving details of what will be transferred by what protocol between what two machines, with what security, etc., etc. And there will be an open source reference implementation available by September. And if you want more information about that, then there's a website link for you there. And all those projects and many more, you can find listed on a relatively brand-spanking new open source website. And that link, and hopefully that website will continue to grow as those of us who write software in the BBC to say, persuade our bosses that open source is the future. Okay, now the second part of my talk is about digital TV hacks. I'm sure a lot of you were in here for the BBC Backstage launch earlier, where you learn that BBC is great, you need to take its online content and do fantastically cool things with it. Well, we make content available in other ways than on the web. Of course, we broadcast television in other ways. So I'm going to start by talking briefly about what makes up DVB norms and DVB is digital video broadcasting, and it's the family of standards by which digital television broadcasts in the UK on terrestrial, cable, and satellite. And the fundamental units of digital video broadcasting is the multiplex, which contains several digital TV channels. And certainly, as far as terrestrial is concerned, one digital multiplex tends to take up the same amount of bandwidth as one old analog television channel. So within each DVB multiplex, you have a number of TV channels and some extra stuff like the EPG. And associated with each television channel, we have a number of services. Obviously, you have video and audio. In addition, you have audio description, which is a service for partially sighted people, whereby when there's not much dialogue happening, a commentator reads out a description of what's happening on screen. Subtitles generally broadcast, certainly BBC programs, and often increasingly there's some sort of interactive application that accompanies the program. So if you want to hack away at the stuff we broadcast, you're going to need to get into one of these transport streams. Now there's three ways of doing this. The cheapest, easiest, and simplest way is to go to Maslin, buy yourself PCI USB Ethernet card, and plug it into your spare PC. There's a compatibility list for Linux at that URL. The second way, which is where I tend to use personally, just because of the equipment we have at my home, is to take a suitable PVR. Now, the only one I actually know of is the Topfield TF5800, but that's a PVR with a USB subject for that, which you can copy from your transport stream files or straight onto your PC. You can then play them back directly in VLC and certain other media players, or you can transcode them or burn them to DVD or whatever. Or you can do cool hacks on them. And your third option is some set-top boxes, which are eminently hackable, such as the Dreambox, which is basically itself a Linux box with a digital terrestrial receiver. Once you've got your transport stream, you're going to need to process it somehow. In my experience, the most flexible tool available at the moment is something called Project X, which is a JavaScript application that can take a transport stream input and split out all those components and save them a number of useful formats. You also have the option of using the DVB tools, which I've not personally investigated much, but which intends to be command line tools for processing transport streams. And there's also a tool called PV Instrumento, which is not so useful. It turns an MPEG transport stream into an MPEG program stream, which makes it easier to play back on with certain media players, but it's not so useful for that. So here's an example hack. I actually have this running not live, but in studio real time upstairs in the corner where we're doing the demos. You start off with your DVB transport stream, which comes from a television transmitter, obviously, and you capture that somehow and process it to extract subtitles. Now, unfortunately, from my perspective, subtitles on digital television are broadcast as bitmaps, where obviously the processing would be a lot handier to have in this text format. So, with Unfulfilled, I eventually found GOCR, which is about as good as it gets as far as open source OCR software gets. And you run the subtitles through that, and you get a reasonable approximation to the text from which they're generated. Now, in this case, I then took those subtitles and fed them straight into PySpy, which you may have come across. It's been featured on Slashdot once or twice, most notably in the context of possible social networks and Shakespeare. But what it does is it plots social networks. A social network is a graph which shows the relationships between entities. Now, in the case of the graph you can see there, I think I have a larger version on the next slide. This is an inferred social network diagram for the French Grand Prix, which was a month or two ago now. And what the entities in the graph are the teams and drivers in the race, and links are drawn between them, showing the strength of the relationship, where the relationship refers to anything which could have had an effect on the outcome of the race. Now that's the interpretation. Generating it was simple. I fed the subtitles from the commentary into the application, and then told it to look for the coincidence of two or more entities within the same sentence. So that's a very, very simple way to get an interesting result, which those who follow Formula One closely assure me there's some resemblance to the actual nature of the race. Those are the two tools beyond what I've already talked about, this recent hack, PySpy, and also a quick hack streaming library and visualization code, which will eventually be in that URL, but is not quite yet in a reasonable state of thing. My colleague Gareth Smith and I were up until 2 o'clock this morning to go and get something demo. So, of the various components of the broadcast streaming I talked about earlier, let's start by thinking about EBG data. And these are just some sample ideas which we came up with in a half-hour brainstorming session. So, much like Ben was talking about earlier, this is far from exhaustive, and the cool ideas are yet to come. So, for example, you can track TV trends, possibly dubbing down the TV, if that's your bag, by looking at the incidence of words in EBG data, or you can watch TV, write a TV personality top 10, or you can implement Procmail on TV, and send any program featuring your most hated TV personality straight to dead null. Then there's the possibility of taking TV content and watching it in new ways. If you took the soundtrack and the audio description track, which I was talking about earlier, and mix them together, you end up listening to podcasts and the DVD program that you listen to on your iPhone or whatever. Or you could create a subtitle-triggered slideshow. Every time the subtitles change, you take a screenshot, then you stream those together, and end up with a bit of a bandwidth version of a TV program that you can watch on devices which can't stream video, can't play audio, but can show pictures. Obviously, you've got the option of transcoding your TV stream to DivX, XVIDIA, or of course DivX, and watching it on devices which can play video, which don't have much capacity. Or you can create your own edited highlights of a TV program by searching through the subtitles for keywords and then taking maybe 10 seconds of audio and video from either side. Or you can automatically create yourself your own scrapbook TV program containing every single bit of TV in the last week about Pony. So some more cool stuff to do. This top one is a bit of a leading suggestion. You may have noticed that in all the open source PBR packages available, Comics TV, MinTV, whatever, there is no capability for watching interactive television. This is because there is no open source interpreter available for interactive television. The interpreters available have to be licensed from the manufacturers for extortionate amounts of money. So if anybody wants to do something for the benefit of their television watching humanity, an open source interpreter from interactive TV would be very welcome to do. Then you can extract recipes from the subtitles of cookery program with people through the watching capture, which I'll send you. This is 2005 after all. Or you could run deep detection algorithms against soundtracks. Look for parcel soundtracks which the deep detection algorithms actually give you a beat count. And then use that to detect music, extract it, and then do whatever you want with it. Maybe listen to it. You could run a cut detector on TV programs and determine how pacey they are in the cafe. And then in your PVR. In in your VPR, you can choose to watch TV based on your mood. Or you can run stress analysis software on soundtracks and create a politician life effect. Not a politician's of a life, who knows? So that's about all I've got for you. If you want further information, the BBC Open Source website is the source for all your open source BBC needs. BBC Research and Development is the part of the BBC I work for. You can find information about the projects I've talked about and all the other stuff that we do. I've talked about quite a percent of the stuff that we do at our website, bbc.co.uk/rd. We have a general purpose email address for any general purpose email. And of course, you're welcome to contact me about anything I've talked about, and that's my email address at the bottom of the screen there. That's all.
I'm hoping you have questions. Does anybody have questions for either of you? Yes, watch out.
When's the BBC going to be actually putting stuff out in Dirac? Do you hope?
We've announced no plans so far. At the moment, we're talking to the various parts of the BBC to try and engage their interest in the project. We've been talking to people from the Creative Archive project recently. And they seem very interested in the possibility of using Dirac to distribute creative archive content. If you're talking about broadcasting the TV and Dirac, that would be for a very long time just because of the TV still goes to set up boxes like this.
Yes, The combination of enormous grids of TV channels and times and the still relatively limited amount of hard disk space, you can go back 7 days and you can build an enormous system, suggests to me that you need TiVo's thumbs up, thumbs down system, or something like it, but outside the TiVo's, anything like that?
Well, one thing we had discussed was your ability to cull by genre, so you know. Straight off, that you're not really interested in any sports programs, so anything tagged sports, you wouldn't bother to record it. Likewise with children's TV, or even whole channels, just a major recording, CBeebies or YouTube, whatever. That there are broad ways in which you could increase the amount of space you've got there for the things that you actually want to watch. But there's the nice thing about TV is there's still an aspect of serendipity to it, and there's things that you don't know that you want to watch. That should really be there, you know, for you to chance upon still. That's still something that you don't get with TiVo or any of the others that are explicit about what they record.
But then you need the feedback of lots of people watching it to then sort of say to your own system, keep this around a bit longer.
Yes, you could have some kind of recommendation social software that is layered on top of somehow. It's still early days yet, but there are many ways in which you can open up a community aspect to it where you trust certain people's views and what they have watched and haven't watched. Or that's certainly interesting area.
I think for us as well, we're looking at internally because we've got a number of projects, navigation across millions of different devices, which, you know, is just a couple. But the important part is storing massive amounts of it. Yes, there's clever ways to do friends stuff. Yes, there's good ways of recommendations. So what happens when it's all there? We want it to be difficult to navigate at the moment. We want there to be so much that we've got to come up with a better metaphor than just a grid.
Have you looked at analysing user patterns to predict future behaviour, both within that system and possibly from other systems, say the web choices or even other choices?
Well, the idea of this is that it records everything, but the EPG layer on top of that can promote things that you may or may not want to watch based upon what you have watched before. That's not an area that we're looking at right now. Right now, that box represents a cutting-edge technology in terms of just about overcoming various hurdles to do with the kit that represents. So the fun stuff happens now, where you say, so well, how do we get to what we want? And that's more of your job.
I mean, it's also important for us that this box and others that we're working on, working with people, that none of them have net connections. They are entirely standalone, and that's for two reasons. The first is because almost all free from struggle digital boxes are not connected to any sort of network. They're just passive devices which receive information. So these work in the same way. The second is that we kind of want to keep it just broadcast at the moment, because that allows it, for example, to be used in portable devices that might never have a net connection, that might be, you know, that's somewhere in the future of 3D transmission will be much better than it is now, that they might be able to pick up TV would then be able to get on the net.
Two quick questions about DRM. DRM, has that been kind of considered or posted upon you? And secondly, streaming. You mentioned that it could be used for streaming. Are you going to release some sort of implementation of a streaming server for DRM?
I assume it's all about digital rights on
that.
Yeah. DRM is just a video codec. There's no reason why you couldn't map to DRM if you wanted to. As far as I know, you can see it depends on that. The second question was,
if you're going to be doing streaming, presumably you will write some sort of streaming server, and you can do that with your own content.
That's an interesting question.
Slide it there, but
put it this way, we wrote DLAF because there was no comparable solution available on BBC's terms. If that was the case for a streaming server, then we would take seriously applying for those as well. But if there's a solution out there, then I would use that instead. I don't know what this is we're going to do.
So I've racked my brains for a way to phrase this as a question, but I can't even come up with a finish to fig leaf, so I'm just going to make a brief comment if you'll indulge me. The DVB, the Digital Video Broadcasters Forum, that runs the standards that all the digital television that we've just seen is built on, has over the last 3 or 4 years been almost completely co-opted by Motion Picture Studios from America. Their executive has been taken over by American Motion Picture executives. They've struck a committee called the Copy Protection Content Management Group that is building a standard that would require that all implementations of DVB receivers be designed to resist end user modification, so you couldn't implement anything that received a digital television signal or sat downstream of a receiver in open source or free software. And finally, they've conceived of an elaborate restrictions vocabulary that can be applied to programs, so you can say things in a program like, only allow this program to be watched within a household, so they require all devices to detect whether they are inside or outside of the household that the initial device received it from, or don't allow this to be watched on more than one screen, or don't allow this to be watched more than once, or for more than 24 hours, or what have you. And there's a genuine danger. If there's anyone in the room who works for a company that's a DVB member, or anyone who works for a company that might find 10,000 euros to join the DVB and work on this, I'd be very happy to talk to them.
Just one quick point. I noticed a few people scribbled out hastily as Steve whizzed through his slide. If anyone's interested in the PVR box with the USB port on the back, it's a top field TF5800. It has 160 gig disk and it costs about 300 quid. No, I don't work for them.
The box that you were showing earlier, any idea how long it might take until something like that actually comes on the market and how much it would cost, and whether if something like that was actually sold by the BBC, you allow it to have something like an internet connection to allow basically the movies and whatever to be taken on to another machine?
Well, in terms of cost, it's roughly comparable to a plasma screen, say. So it's a few thousand pounds right now. Obviously, it's hard to write. The major cost of that is the storage. So as the storage drops, so does the cost. As far as it being a product, that's an interesting one. We don't know at the moment what the state of the market is in terms of payments and the fields to do with the legality of this as well. So it's a bit of a minefield right now. But we are looking at that. And I don't know, we're getting on in.
what we do in Interactive TV is we work 99% of the services that we provide are done by Sky or the Code Codes or the Freeview Review, and that is quite clearly there's a big exception to that. What we've been doing, as I said, the last 6 to 12 months is boost up just because we can. So if we tried to pose it this as a device that we could sell 12 months ago, it would have seemed quite bizarre, quite far off. Such a shift compared to TiVo or video recording. So I think we're still exploring, to be honest, before we even begin to think about any of those questions.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah. We're asking anyone else who's interested what's to do next. And I think that we're going to keep doing that before we start thinking about any of those questions.
Okay, I'm going to have a question. I'd like to point out that all the presentations made in the book today will be put up online. And this is a thank you.